Welcome to the House Water Committee. And we're going to go a little bit out of order today. We want to have a quick work session on House Bill 2881. And with that, I would like to have a motion. Representative Crummell.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2881 without recommendation to as to passage and move it to the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources by prior reference.
Thank you, Representative. Are there any questions on this? It appears that the House, the Ag and Natural Resources, want to hear this bill, and as a consequence, it seems unfair to ask people to come halfway across the United States to the state of Oregon to testify twice on this bill.
Seems like halfway across the United States sometimes.
Yes, it does. As you make a trip over and back in one day, it sometimes gets to be that way. So, with that, Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, do we have any idea what the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee plans to do with this bill?
Not particularly.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Is there any objection? None? Hearing none, so ordered. And with that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2881. And we'll go to a public hearing on House Bill 2082. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2082. Thank you. And would you, I'm sorry if I, would you update us a little bit on this, Sandy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 2082 comes to you from the Department of State Lands. It's requesting final legislative approval to authorize the Department of State Lands to administer the permits for the removal fill materials under Section 404 of the Federal Water Pollution Control Act. It declares an emergency, and it is effective upon passage.
Thank you, and I see we have three... I believe it's three members here that are in something in excess of 100 miles. So as per our usual, we will allow all of those folks who are from further away to testify first on this. And I think I have Keith Nelson, and is it Bob Caravan and Ronald Bjork? And could you perhaps all three come up at the same time? Yeah, I know. Okay. Good afternoon, gentlemen. And if you would, Mr. Nelson first, that's agreeable.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Keith Nelson. I'm president of the Josephine County Farm Bureau, a member of Farm Bureau's Removal and Fill Committee, and a 30-year board member of the Soil and Water Conservation District. My wife, Jerry, and I have truck farmed the same land in Kirby, Oregon, for nearly 50 years. We've worked hard all our lives and are lucky enough to have children who not only share our love of farming but wish to continue this family business after our retirement, if they ever let us retire. Over time, we have witnessed more and more government intrusion, rules and regulations that make our operation more costly, labor-intensive and time-consuming, and in no way contributes to the end product. While we take pride in our stewardship of the land and its adjacent river, we are forced to weigh every action we take for fear of breaking some agency's rule. We have seen too many of our fellow farmers and ranchers face fines, penalties, and even criminal arrest for good management practices that have always been employed by farmers. They haven't done anything harmful to the environment. They just didn't ask the right agency for permission to do a project on their own land. Thanks to Farm Bureau, agriculture has at least enjoyed some exceptions under the removal and fill law, though even these are regularly challenged by DSL's controversial interpretation of the law. Should House Bill 2082 pass, many of the exemptions that allow us to farm without a costly and complicated permit process for just about everything will disappear. And DSL will be given even more regulatory authority. At the proposed $10,000 per day fine, just one fine would completely wipe us out. We don't want to sell or subdivide our farm. We just want to leave our kids with the ability to farm without fear and continue to actually produce the necessary product, food. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Questions? Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Nelson, for your testimony. I'm a little bit confused, and this is the first that I've heard of the bill. And as I understand it, the purpose is to streamline so that there are not two permits required, both one from the federal government, one from the state government. So am I missing something here?
Yeah, you'd actually still have to get permit from the Corps. And DSL.
Something I'm missing, Representative Dean Felder?
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think that probably Division of State Land should answer this question, but if I'm hearing you right, the concern is about the 50 cubic yard exemption, the removal of that exemption under the state assumption process. We're trying to figure out what exactly the concern is that you're raising, because currently you have to go to the Corps and to the Division of State Lands to get permits. And the discussion is about streamlining the process. So am I understanding correctly that that's a concern about the 50 cubic yard exemption removal?
That's one of them, yes.
Okay. Maybe we'll get a little clearer understanding of that whole issue as we get further into it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson.
Is it Caravan? Caravan?
Sorry, I'm a little hard of hearing.
So am I.
That's my microphone over there. My name is Bob Caravan. I thank the committee for giving me time to give testimony. I've just got a few points here. This thing started in 2001 under Senate Bill 172. Then under Senate Bill 170 in 2003, they tried to get it through and they couldn't get the vote, so they pulled it. They, being the DSL, pulled it off the agenda. And now they're trying to run it through the House. Personally, I would take it as an insult if I were you. They're thinking that you people don't have the experience that the rest of us do, and just by the questions that you ask. And it would take a Philadelphia lawyer to understand this completely. And I've hired a couple of Philadelphia lawyers, so I know where I'm coming from. I was arrested and it took before the criminal system, and through that allowed me to take depositions, and through deposition we have sworn statement from two DSL employees and one state police officer that there was a meeting in 1995 in Bend, Oregon, where they discussed using Jackson and Josephine County as guinea pigs, the farmers in them, and to use criminal law against farmers, but only in Jackson and Josephine County. This bill was voted in at, in 2001 at 29-1, 30 senators. There was one senator against it, and that was Jason Atkinson. And the reason he voted against it is he knew what was going on in reference to their using Jackson and Josephine County as their guinea pigs. So because I was under criminal law, there was no bargaining. I had to go get a criminal attorney, and we had to go back over the history of the felony removal law, because that's what the courts want. And we went back to the very beginning. And the felony removal law originally was put together to control aggregate miners. And that's the main thing you got to understand. And through the, they tried to get it through through the Senate, and they couldn't get the vote. So they, because there was a farm bureau senators that were against it. So the farm bureau senators, representing farm areas, made sure that they put exemptions in for farmers. And the felony removal law is full of exemptions. And it really takes a lawyer to figure most of them out. But when it comes up for, when it came up under criminal, we were forced to figure that out. Since that time, the law as it is today, but if the assumption goes through, it's already written in the books. It's already there. It's just got to be voted one more time through one more legislature, and then it becomes law. And it used to be a fine of $10,000. You know, if you do anything wrong, it's a fine of $10,000. Now there's, in this new assumption law, the worst thing about it is $10,000 per day. Now, it took me 3 years to get to trial. So if it was $10,000 a day, that would be $3,650,000 a year times 3 years if I was found guilty. The reason they do this is that nobody can fight. If they take a stand, whether they're right or wrong, if they take a stand, they lose everything they own. And this is a bipartisan law, if there ever was one, or argument, if there ever was one, because it's the little guy that loses. People, I happen to have enough money to fight him. And I spent approximately $350,000 to get to where I am today. And I feel that the DSL has spent over $1.5 million on me alone. And what they do in all this stuff, and Senate Bill, if you go back and read Senate Bill 172 from the 2001 legislature, it gives them carte blanche to spend as much money as they want until they get the assumption. And I say that it's upwards of 10 to 15 million. Now, they don't take this money out of the school funds. They just don't put it in the school funds. In other words, it becomes costs. They say that I filed a civil suit against the DSL for $3.6 million and won. And now they're appealing that. In other words, and the money is not coming out of the school funds, it's just not going into the school fund. We've had senators ask the powers to be at DSL to submit how much money they've been spending on all of the things that they have to do with felony removal law. They have yet to come up with it. They haven't. They gave testimony last week or the week before that on the increase in the fees, that if the increase of fees go through, it'll drop the cost from 30% down to 17%. That was their testimony. But they don't say 30% of what, or 17% of what. And I think this, I think you people should ask what is what. In other words, you should demand to know how much money they're throwing away on this stuff. I figure in my case alone, I have 130 acres, and about 20 acres of them are in the riverbed itself. Not water, but just riverbed. Some of it used to be farmland, but it was washed away. And I say, under the regulations today, there are tens of thousands of those acres, those type of acres, that are covered. Under assumption, it would be hundreds of thousands of acres. And the reason is the Borden case. The Corps of Engineers, you can tell I learned a lot about this in the past. And my job is to sell wine, not to know legal things. But the Borden case, they were 300 feet above any rivers or drainage ditches, 300 feet high, and they were deep ripping their ground. So to break the hard pan up so the roots can go down through the hard pan. This has been an operation that has been going on since the 1850s in all farming, all over the United States. If you have hard pan, you deep rip and try to break it. They argued the case against the Corps of Engineers, who was behind the assumption bill, and they lost because they said that the water would go down to the hard pan and then follow the hard pan down to 300 feet to a waterway, and they were. Under a recapture plan, they were taking away water for the plants that would normally go into navigation. And they were fined $5 million. And it was upheld, and they appealed it, it was upheld. Now, I don't know how many farmers there are in Oregon that can afford a $5 million fine. I think you could probably count them on one hand, two at the most. So that's a lot. It's bad law. It also, under 404, Clean Water Act, Section 10 waters aren't involved. Section 10 waters are anything that's navigable, which is all these streams up here, and any adjacent wetlands to that navigability. So the up here where the elevation is, I don't know, 60 feet above sea level or less, those are all Section 10 waters, and they still will stay under the Corps of Engineers. Plus, the EPA is in this up to their eyeballs, and the EPA has the last say, and I would they can override anything. And now I'm going to throw one clincher at you. It also in the law, and it's already written in the law. It's in the books. You can read it. It's just not in effect yet. They can let any interested party intervene in a permit application. And if you think about the interested parties that are fooling around now with the U.S. Forest Service and logging, you'll know what kind of a Pandora box you've got. In other words, this bill is bad. It will wipe out farming as it's known today. And I think that there was an article put out by the DSL, I think it was in 2002, I'm not sure, but they Ann Hannes wrote it up and gave it to the board, and in it they told how many permits they issued, and in it they issued one permit for agriculture, one in that year. Under this plan, if assumption goes in, you're going to be talking about tens of thousands of permits. And they also, and I'd like you folks to look it up, they have a MOA, a Memorandum of Understanding, with the Corps. Because under this plan, the Corps are going to lose some jobs. Because they're not going to... And under this plan, they're going to hire those Corps members and put them on the Oregon taxpayers' payroll. And I think it's atrocious. I think we should be trying to figure out how to get money into the school fund, not how to take money out of the school fund. And I thank you very much.
Thank you very kindly, sir. I appreciate your testimony. This is Ronald Bjork. Is that correct pronunciation?
That's right. You did a good job. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Ronald Bjork, president of Jackson County Farm Bureau and the chair of the Oregon Farm Bureau Special Committee on Fill and Removal. Today, this committee will be considering House Bill 2082, the division of lands so-called by them as streamlining bill, where they assume Section 404 of the Federal Clean Water Act. The state pays all the costs. That's something you got to keep in mind, that the state's the one that's going to pay everything. The original bill that was passed in 2001, called Senate Bill 172, this bill was passed without any understanding or its ramifications or its cost. Then the 2003 legislature started to understand all of the problems that would affect landowners if the bill was passed. It seems funny that not more than three states passed an assumption bill, and they did this in the very first year after it was passed with the federal government. And since in the last 10 years, none of them have passed it, as the assumption bill has caused a lot of problems and lots of extra costs for the state. I keep bringing this up. This is something you want to be sure to ask. Who's going to pay all these costs? The landowners. This bill does not streamline the permitting process. The Corps of Engineers will not let the state assume Section 10 waters. The Corps will have the final say on them. This is just another layer of bureaucracy. It would put another burden on our farmers with fines of $10,000 a day at the whim of DSL. And they interpret the law. We as farmers are not guilty without the due process of law. And this particular bill makes, if they do pick us up for anything, we're in a felon case, not a civil case. My concerns, my committee has worked with DSL, but it's only one-way street, their way or no way. I believe the agency needs to be reined in and totally reviewed. Or better yet, do away with DSL and move what they do to other agency, saving the state lots of money. Thank you for this opportunity to speak today.
Thank you very much, Ronald. I appreciate all of you gentlemen's comments and presentations to it. One just very quick sort of observation about the, was it Senate Bill 170 that was heard on the Senate side this session? Was that the one that you were talking about?
I didn't hear what.
No, the original bill was 172
yes.
That passed, and 170 was the Senate bill that is still
2003.
No, that was this year.
Here, yeah. Then the question was something to have to, having to do with the effect of the two different bills on, you know, and the implication that this bill came to the House after Senate Bill 170 got beat up over on the Senate side.
Yeah.
I think that's incorrect. They were pretty much, I think, jointly filed in the House and in the Senate, and I know that I had this bill in my possession before the hearings took place on the Senate side. So just as a clarification on that issue, that I don't believe the department was trying to come in the back door here after losing the battle on the other side. It's not uncommon for bills to be introduced on in both chambers.
Well, they,
please.
They had the bill, Senate Bill 170 in 2003 legislature. All I need is the, a majority vote, and it's law. This thing is already in the law books.
I understand.
They realized they didn't want to take the chance and let it go to a vote because they knew it was going to be voted down. And they pulled the bill. Now, as far as I'm concerned, that means they were scared to get a vote. And now they're coming to you people, and I think it's sort of, it's a real involved issue, and it's going to take a lot of study to realize how bad it is.
Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your
Thank
time.
Thank you.
Appreciate your
Thank
time.
Thank you.
At this point, we would like to hear from the department. We have and Eric Metz with the department.
Thank you, Chair Jensen, members of the committee. I'm going to give a presentation on our streamlining efforts. I'll be focusing not just on 2082, but looking at a range of different efforts that Department of State Lands has been involved with. Excuse me, it's a little hard for me to turn my neck. The removal bill law was enacted in 1967 for removal and 71 for fill. It protects functions and values of state waters. Basically, it requires people that are planning to remove or fill waters of the state to obtain a permit from DSL. We process about 1,000 applications annually. I should add that wetlands was added to the removal fill law in 1989. The purpose of the removal fill law is to protect, conserve, and make the best use of water resources. This includes protecting navigation, fisheries, recreational uses. It ensures that the activities of one landowner don't adversely affect another. It also minimizes flooding, maintaining water quality, and protecting fish and wildlife habitat. During, let me talk a little bit about some of the things that we've done. Provide for every application that's submitted a customer service survey. We've also conducted telephone surveys during the summer to see how we're doing on a random selection of all applications. Of the in 2004, we issued 98.6% of permits, that's 373 of them, within 90 days after a completed application was received. And the average number of days to issue it was 66. This is based on a performance measure that we have. We also, as I mentioned, did those customer service surveys in 03 and 04, and we've had a moderate and stable level of customer satisfaction, rating our staff services from good to excellent between 61 and 76%. We have two different types of permits. We have a general authorization permit, which is essentially an expedited permit, and then we have individual permits. The general authorization permits are for selected categories, and you'll see here that the largest amounts of those general authorizations go for placer mining, fish habitat enhancement, roads, And then erosion control and tidal channel maintenance, those are areas where often agriculture may use, or it may also be used by other landowners. And then wetland enhancement, restoration work. We now have a new general authorization called minimal disturbance. That allows people that are doing one-tenth of an acre to get a general authorization. It basically expedites their permit process from what they were having to do before. And then pilings and tidal channel maintenance. But I think the point on that one is to show you that the large number of permits are in areas not just including agriculture, but areas primarily for roads and construction. For the individual permits, wetland fills, which are often for construction purposes, are the largest type of permit we have, followed by roads and bridges. Utilities use it, as well as this also includes other types of projects.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dinkelberg.
Thank you. I have a question. Ms. Hannes, on these permits, do you have full-time staff that works on enforcement, or how do you deal with enforcement, making sure that any of these projects are being done within the permit conditions outlined by Division of State Lands?
We reorganized regarding enforcement. In the past year, we used to have one or two staff devoted to enforcement. Now what happens is that enforcement is part of the resource permit coordinator's job that has that particular territory.
A follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
So how would that work? Would that mean that the person who has written the permit and is working with the applicant goes out and visits the site, or would somebody have to call in and make a complaint? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out. I understand how the stormwater permits work at DEQ, but I wanted to find out how you deal with complaints, or is this a complaint-driven process?
Chair Jensen, Representative Dinkfelder, it's primarily a complaint-driven process. We really don't have the staff to be able to go out there and patrol, if you will. We hear complaints from neighbors. It may be somebody that that is driving by and seeing it. We also may find that there is a violation because somebody hasn't followed through with what they said they were going to do for their application.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. Under state law, we were mandated to pursue streamlining objectives. We were under that law, ORS 196-795, which was passed in 1997, it charges us with reducing unnecessary paperwork, eliminating duplication, increasing certainty and timeliness, enhancing resource protection, as well as investigating the what we call the statewide programmatic general permit, or SPGP, and 404 assumption of the Clean Water Act. I'm going to talk about some of the initiatives we've been engaged in. The statewide programmatic general permit is actually a permit that we would get from the Army Corps of Engineers, because right now EPA delegates authority to carry out the Clean Water Act for 404 to the Army Corps of Engineers. What we've done with the Army Corps of Engineers is work with them and negotiate, and it's taken quite a long time to agree to a statewide programmatic general permit whereby they delegate certain types of activities for us to cover. So in other words, if you are consistent with those particular activities, you come to DSL and you get your permit and you don't have to go through the Army Corps of Engineers. So it's a streamlining effort. 404 assumption basically would include all but those Section 10 waters. They're not consistent with each other. And one of the good news for that is that I want to mention that we will be signing that with the colonel at the State Land Board meeting on April 12th. And we're planning on implementing that in the fall of 2005. We've also had two new general authorizations that we've put together. One relates to the ODOT bridge project, so it allows those bridges and road work to get done much more quickly through the permit process. And I'd already mentioned the small wetland fill general authorization. We've put placer and prospector permits online so that it's much easier for people to be able to get those permits. And also now, as an applicant, if you want to see where your removal fill permit is at, you can go online at our website and check and see exactly where you are in the process, so it doesn't just go into a black hole. You know exactly what's going on, and you can see who has commented on your application.
Representative Barnard.
Thank you. Could we back up just 1 second? The general authorization you have on ODOT bridges, is that connected in any way with what we're talking about today in this bill, or is that a separate agreement that you have?
Chair Jensen, Representative Barnhart, that's a separate agreement. What I was trying to say in this slide is that there are a number of other types of streamlining efforts that we're engaged in addition to the 404 assumption. Because
Thank you.
I view it fairly, you know, very broadly when we're looking at how to streamline this permitting process. And that involves a number of different ways we can go about it.
So another way, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Another way of saying that, then, is that HB 2082 is one segment of a process that is much broader that includes these other things.
Chair Jensen, Representative Barnhart, that's correct. One 404 assumption, if that would happen, is one component of looking at all that we're trying to do with streamlining.
Thank you.
We have done outreach. We've talked and provided training to 48 groups all around the state. This included over 1,300 attendees over the last 2 years. We're also currently engaged in a removal fill process improvement project where we've hired a quality control specialist, and that's being done jointly with DEQ and is also involving other state agencies. Pat Allen from the Governor's Streamlining Office is here if you have any questions about that. But it's been an intensive effort that we've launched, and we're hoping to have recommendations on that in about 5 weeks. The other area that we've been involved with intensively is industrial land certification. This is part of the economic revitalization team, and as a result of this, we've been able to get a number of major industrial sites certified in order to allow development to proceed. Some good examples of that is the Lebanon site, whereby there's going to be a major development and wetland mitigation will be provided there, but in a way that it is not only enhancing the property but allowing that development to go forward. Annie's kitchen that was just recently moved to Medford was also another example of the work we've done there through the economic revitalization team. House Bill 2082 authorizes the state to proceed with assumption. It is part of the governor's streamlining initiative. In order to do this, EPA will need to review the state program for equivalency to the federal program. That is one major step we've yet to go through. And then if that would happen positively for the state, as well as we'd receive approval from the legislature, then EPA would transfer 404 from the Corps to DSL. We do have two representatives from EPA here if you have any questions regarding the assumption and how that would work.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dinkel.
Thank you. Ms. Hannes, I heard you talk about the work that Division of State Lands is doing with the Governor's Office of Streamlining and of Regulatory Streamlining, and I heard you say that you're looking at a recommendation within about 5 weeks, and the question I have is, I mean, should we be proceeding, is this putting the cart before the horse a little bit to speak, in that we're proceeding with this bill before we hear the recommendations out of that streamlining process? I don't know if you have any comments on that.
I think that there's still a lot of work that we're going to need to do with assumption. So this is going to be continuing on for the months ahead. The streamlining efforts we're trying to do with that quality control is not just at 404 assumption, but a number of ways in which the state agencies interact with each other that we can have a cleaner and clearer process. So I think that we're going to be ending up working with EPA over the next year anyway, and we'll be coming back and reporting on that to the legislature.
Okay, thank you.
This goes through and shows you the differences between the DSL and the Army Corps of Engineers process. With DSL having a volume threshold, the Corps does not have any volume threshold. We have a 50 cubic yards. We regulate both removal and fill, where removal is not regulated with the Corps. We don't require Endangered Species Act coordination. However, that is required under federal law. And that we have solid, strict statutory time frames in which to issue the our permit, whereas the Army Corps of Engineers does not have any statutory time frames.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
I just want to make sure I'm following this clearly. So 404 is the Clean Water Bill. Is that correct?
Correct. That's Section 404 of the Federal Clean Water Act. And so Department of Environmental Quality deals with and is responsible for Section 401 of the Clean Water Act, that's been delegated to it by EPA. Right now, EPA delegates authority to enforce and manage the Section 404 to the Army Corps of Engineers. They could just as easily say, DSL do that rather than the Army Corps of Engineers.
I feel like I need something that explains what 401 is and what 404 is. I mean, some of you come in with this information. I certainly don't have this in my brain.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I was going to ask if Ms. Annis would just walk through. I mean, looks like Representative Jensen and I, who've worked with this program for years, but for some of the other committee members, maybe you can just walk through and give a brief description about how the two differ, and I think that would be helpful for the committee members that are trying to wrestle with this issue.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah. How about if I... There's a chart that I'd like to maybe go forward to. This chart outlines the process that DSL goes through versus the process that the Army Corps of Engineers go through. We do a completeness review that takes about 30 days. Then there's a public review, which we have to get public comments. And then the final review takes up to 60 days. And then we issue a permit decision in 90 days. The Army Corps of Engineers does their initial review. They also go through a threatened endangered species process. They have a public notice. They go through consultation if there is an Endangered Species Act requirements, and then they issue a permit decision. Their goal is to issue that permit decision in 120 days. Eric, they're now averaging about meeting that goal about 55% of the time. If you look at the next slide, this is what we're hoping to do with streamlining under 404, where you would go through the DSL process, and except for those Section 10 waters, you would only go through DSL.
Mr. Chair, I'm still unclear of what is meant by 404 and what is meant by 401.
Okay.
Can you go back to the other slide? It might be helpful.
Okay. Maybe I can talk a little bit.
Chair Jensen, Representative Tomei, the Clean Water Act contains numerous sections and various environmental provisions attached to those. Section 404 is a dredge and fill provision of the Clean Water Act. Fiscal impacts.
For the record.
Pardon me? I'm sorry. Eric Metz, Regulatory Policy Specialist, Department of State Lands.
Thank you.
So repeat, please, what you said Section 404 is.
Section 404 is a dredge and fill provisions regulating the placement of dredge and fill material in waters in the United States. Section 401 is a provision that allows, assures that water quality standards are attained in part through issuance of 404 permits. But it's not a physical discharge of fill. They're looking for essentially secondary water quality impacts associated with that fill. So it's a separate section of the Clean Water Act. That section has been delegated, the administration of that section has been delegated to the State Department of Environmental Quality. So when the Corps of Engineers issues a Section 404 permit, the Department of Environmental Quality has to certify under Section 401 that it meets the state's water quality standards. So it's a two-part test. It takes two different parts. The Corps permit has to be consistent with both parts of the Clean Water Act, Section 404 and 401.
May I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
I'm sorry, but this is kindergarten for me. So in 404, DEQ needs to certify that 401 is met with 404.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Tomei, in some instances, for example, from the Nationwide Permit Program, DEQ certifies those up front so the Corps can administer the streamlined Nationwide Permit Program. But for an individual permit that's reviewed case by case, DEQ has to make that certification each time.
Okay, thank you.
Can't get there. Anne, we're going to have to
I will wrap
speed up quickly
okay.
in the process, if you could, please.
Let me wrap up here pretty quickly. What we're hoping to do with streamlining is to reduce unnecessary paperwork, eliminate duplication, increase certainty, and ensure resource protection. I think overall it makes good business sense to do this. Because we've been focusing so much of our time to try to get the statewide programmatic general permit in place, we don't have a full package that we can show you in terms of the work we've done with the EPA. That's something we're going to need to be working on over this next year once we have the SPGP in place. So what I'd be asking is that we'd like to continue the work of with stakeholders on 404 assumption and streamlining the removal fill program over this next year during the interim.
Thank you, Anne. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the previous witnesses, or maybe a couple of them, testified about the increasing complexity of paperwork or bureaucratic involvement. I forget exactly what the language was for processes involving less than 50 cubic yards. Could you comment on that concern and how this is connected with that, if it is?
Chair Jensen, Representative Barnhart. It's interesting because if you require a permit with the state, you also require a permit with the Army Corps of Engineers. And the Army Corps of Engineers doesn't have a volume requirement. So you have to do one anyway for the Army Corps of Engineers in addition to DSL. There's ways that we can work with applicants if we get this so that it helps. Where we can say up front, if you meet these criteria, then you don't have to worry about that 50 cubic yard exemption and be able to have exemptions in law that address various concerns. So, but that's something I think we can work on with groups in the year ahead. I think fundamentally, if you get this, you're not going to have to deal with one whole branch of federal government. And you go basically through the state process, you get your permit, and you get it in a certain time frame.
Well, if I could follow up. Is this related to equivalency in some way? I mean, what I'm hearing sounds to me as though the state government has a cutoff below which you don't need a permit, and the federal government doesn't. And yet you have to meet an equivalency requirement in order to get that 404 delegation. What is that? How does that connect with this piece?
Chair Jensen, Representative Barnhart, there's a lot of different ways to look at equivalency, and that's what we'd be working with EPA. Equivalency doesn't necessarily mean that you have to have every part of your laws be exactly the same.
Thank you. I don't think I want to hear any more. I appreciate what you've said so far.
Yeah.
I don't think I want to go anywhere with that statement that you made, Representative.
That's why this has taken us so long.
I just got it. Sorry, I'm slow. Okay. Any other questions for the panel?
Okay.
Thank you.
We'd be
much.
Here to answer any questions, and as I mentioned, there are representatives here from EPA that can also answer any of your questions.
Fine. Thank you. Let me have Rick Angstrom, Greg Addington, and Dale Buck. And gentlemen, could I ask you to be brief as possible? Rick, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, while he's passing out information, may I start?
Please.
My name's Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association. When this bill initially went through as Senate Bill 172, I was the chair of the state's Healthy Stream Partnership. And a little background, this bill came as part of the salmon recovery effort when the governor's office came to the Healthy Stream Partnership and requested that the Healthy Stream Partnership tackle this assumption issue. The state agencies were having a difficult time going through the two permit process, as was the industry, in getting some of the activities done for recovery of fish. So the Healthy Stream Partnership, which was a fairly broad constituency, including cattlemen, farmers, OFIC, OCAPA, environmental interests, local governments, tackled this issue and brought it before the legislature. And at that point, we were in alignment in supporting it, and 172 got through the legislature. Since that time, when it got over to the Senate, though, some of the farm interests, because of the Bob Caravan controversy, were starting to get pretty vocal. And when we were over on the Senate side, at that time, Senator Messersohn was charged with handling the bill. And his view was, because all the details weren't worked out on 404 assumption, that we would go ahead and pass the bill, but we'd hold off on the final adoption in order for DSL to do some rulemaking and some work that they needed to do as far as constituent work to get everybody lined up. In the interim, DSL did do some of that work, but unfortunately I don't think it's met the satisfaction of the agricultural community, which is where we're at now. But the bill still has a lot of merit. And what it's about is reducing permitting down to one function. Right now, from our side of it, wearing the OCAPA hat here, we have to go through both a federal and a state permit in order to do our activities. And that duplication costs time, energy, and money. And the worst part of it is when we get a permit from both DSL and the Corps, they often don't match, which puts the operators in a world of hurt. I think Representative Barnhart would remember the Umpqua Santa Gravel, the dredging operation, that the article a few years ago that hit the paper down there out of the Registered Guard, where here you had an operator that had conditions from DSL and conditions from the Corps. None of them matched. They met the conditions of one agency and not the other, and vice versa. It was just a mess. So from our side of it is this is good policy for the state. It benefits the recovery effort for fish. It benefits the sand and gravel industry. We're still interested, OCAP is still interested in working with the agricultural community, trying to find a resolution to this. The ag folks have indicated what they are interested in is federal equivalency, and I think we need to continue working there. The big rub, for all your sake, is this 50 cubic yard exemption. The state has a 50 cubic yard exemption. The feds do not. Right now, the feds don't really enforce against agricultural interests. So the state still has, they still have to fall under the state standard, but they would not necessarily under the federal standard. And it's become a bit of a pinch point in the debate But what DSL's done, and what they did in the interim, is they found a general authorization process where they essentially said, you know, what we want to do here is, ag community, you can have a general authorization, but you got to make DEQ water quality standards. You got to take care of the fish and the guidelines on the fish, and basically some general categories for a general authorization that would have been in kind of a permit in statute as long as they complied. The hard part here is, our guys are still going through the two-permit process, and we're increasingly finding it difficult to get permits from the feds for in-water activities because of the interests of NOAA Fisheries and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which are increasingly concerned about any kind of aggregate removal out of the rivers. And my guess is, at some point, this will catch up with the ag interests too, where they will also have the same problems with getting any kind of aggregate material, whether it's used on site or for commercial purposes, for the farm use or for commercial purposes, out of the feds. And that's just a matter of time. I think it's, so what's going on is until we work this out, very difficult on private industry from our side of it. Our recommendation is this is still good law. It needs to pass. We need to bring the agricultural folks along so that they're comfortable with it. Speaking direct, Chair, is I don't think that's going to happen until the lawsuit and the caravan case is settled. I think that until that resolves itself, the agricultural interests will not be able to find accommodation to get this bill through. So that includes my testimony. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Rick. Appreciate your thoughts on this. Mr. Addington? And you thought you were going to get out of here without any more work, huh?
I can hope, yeah. You fixed that for me, though.
Mr. Addington is going to be leaving us, in case you're unaware of it, members. He's found a more lucrative employer that is calling him. So appreciate this may be the last time he's before us. But we'll probably draw him back from his other job at some other time. So
I think that's highly likely, Mr. Chairman, yes.
Please, Greg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. And for the record, I'm Greg Addington with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. Appreciate the opportunity to provide some comment on House Bill 2082. And I guess with Mr. Angstrom's permission, I'll go ahead and give the Farm Bureau's view of what this bill, how it affects agriculture. And I want to say up front, too, that I know that that Rich, from the gravel industry standpoint, is trying to do what's best for his industry, and I want to do everything I can to stay out of the way of them. I mean, I expect that's what he should do, and we don't have a problem with that. Likewise, we have to look out what's best for our industry, and we're having some trouble making those two things line up. But and I would also point out in the handouts that you've got for me, I apologize, my written testimony is far too long, but I was boiling down a stack of papers, and that's as small as I could get it, so I also put a little summary in there too, so that might be easier for you to follow. I'll try to be as brief as possible. I think you've heard some background on this issue. It appears to me, and it certainly is a bit confusing, but this process all started really about in the 2001 session with Senate Bill 172. And as you know, what I want to underscore is the fact that the legislation that you are considering is more than the half page that's in front of you with 2082. What you are really considering is the 14 pages of word changes that are made in Senate Bill 172 from the 2001 session. That wording is in current statute.
Could I interrupt
yes, sir.
A little bit, members, for your purposes? If you want to have a look at that, you could find it in the small print under the ORS's 196-800. Would give you the material that Mr. Addington is referring to. on that, and it might be worthwhile to have a look at that. Please proceed, Craig.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's exactly right. The, as I call it, the fine print. And it takes, it's in a statute, but it takes an action of a future legislature to codify it and make it happen. And that's what this bill would do. So I encourage you to please look at that language before before making a decision on this. And that's what a lot of the testimony you've heard so far is referring to, is the language in the fine print. Removal fill on this state, as far as I'm concerned, is as complicated as it gets. There are federal laws that supersede state law, and there are pages and pages of confusing and ambiguous language in our current statutes. This legislation, in our opinion, is not streamlining. It only adds to the vague nature of our state laws and leaves the interpretation up to state agencies and the rulemaking process. EPA and the Corps of Engineers have and will maintain the ultimate authority in this entire process. There are at least 60 stream or river segments that you've heard referred to already as Section 10 waters, and I have a list of those as well. This does not include harbors and bays, but there's 60 water bodies on the west side of the state, primarily the Coast Range, that would not be assumable under this program. That regulation will remain with the federal government. So if we're really talking about streamlining, the only true way to streamline and simplify, as I think Mr. Angstrom pointed out, is for the state to get out of the removal and fill business, because the ultimate authority lies with the federal government and always will. Farm-related activities that are governed under the fill and removal laws are essential to agriculture, especially on the west side of the state. Some different examples of activities are push-up dams to divert water for irrigation, the need to clean and perform maintenance on irrigation and drainage ditches, protection of stream banks from severe erosion caused by floods, as well as maintenance of pumps, riprap, and tide gates. We believe most agricultural activities that we are concerned about with regard to the removal fill activities fall under a current set of exemptions in state and federal law. The exemptions were put into place by past legislators to protect agriculture, and because most of these activities are small in nature when compared to larger construction or dredging projects. As we look at assumption, we see it as a combining of federal and state law. And the question for us becomes, which regulations affect the agricultural community? Are we regulated under the DSL statutes or under the Corps of Engineers statutes code? A little bit on the cost issue that seems to come up. In the past, I've heard the department make the statement that this program is not going to cost the agency, the general fund, or the common school fund any more money than is currently being spent. However, in the last 10-plus years, only two states have gone through this assumption process. And according to an EPA fact sheet, some of the reasons states have expressed for not more actively pursuing assumption include lack of funding, limit of program administration to non-navigable waters, and concerns regarding federal requirements and oversight. Director Hannis is on record in January of 2001 before the House Natural Resource Committee as saying that the department plans on pursuing assistance from federal agencies to help offset the cost. There clearly is going to be a cost to this program. And I bring this issue up in light of recent hearings about DSL fee increases and accusations that the Common School Fund is somehow subsidizing agricultural or the removal and fill program. If indeed these minor agricultural activities need to be regulated, then we want one clear set of regulations and exemptions. The federal and state programs differ in some significant ways. They both have good and bad things that we like. But overall, when we look at the assumption, the current assumption proposal, it's like a combination of those two programs, only from our standpoint, they're combining the worst of both programs. That's why we oppose this bill and will continue to oppose assumption as it is currently written. And Mr. Chair, that concludes my testimony. I do have some written testimony from some individuals that were not able to be here, if I could turn that in.
If you would, please. They will become part of the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Thank you. And Mr. Buck.
Chairman Jensen and members of the House Water Committee, my name is Dale Buck. I live at 25590 Chinook Street, Cloverdale, Oregon, 97112. And I right off, let me say that I'm a country boy wandering aimlessly through life. And some of these things I have a hard time understanding. But I'm a retired dairy farmer. I'm carrying a mortgage on a farm that has 3,000 feet of drainage ditch on it that we clean once in a while. I would like for you to oppose this bill, and I've given you some written testimony. I made mine short, a lot shorter than Greg did his, and so you can read it when you...
Thank you, Dale. I mean,
when you are having trouble sleeping. But it does involve more than just Senate House Bill 2082. It involves the old 172 and the new 170. And some things that bother me a little bit or concern me are like in what the agency gave you this morning is in this sheet here, DSL Corp's process. Well, they gave me a side-by-side, and theirs, new one, doesn't list wetlands that I can see. I don't have very good eyesight. But in the one I got earlier on the core side, isolated wetlands not regulated, but on DSL side, isolated wetlands regulated. And they are regulated, I'll tell you they are. And it's those little things that are left out that bother agriculture. DSL wants to take away farm exemptions, give them back in rural form, in BMPs. Those kinds of things are done after the fact. We don't know how they're going to read. We're left to argue with DSL in future years. And David Allnut, who's an attorney for EPA, who's sitting in the back, faxed me some of EPA's BMPs. And I think maybe he sent me the ones that they wanted to use. He wasn't sure. So those are things that bother us. And as Mr. Engstrom has mentioned, litigation has caused the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation and the House of Delegates to put in a policy book that they want to go back to pre-1999 to ORS 196.800 to 196.905. And those Section 10 waters are all of the coast waters plus all salt water. But you might be surprised. Dairy Quick in Washington County, which you can almost step across, has 8.3 miles of Section 10 waters in it. The Tualatin River is a Section 10 water from its outflow in the Willamette River in Lake Oswego until it intercepts with Gales Creek up by Hillsboro. Some 56 miles of Section 10 water right through the middle of Washington, Clackamas County. So it's not just, but it does include almost all of our coastal rivers, creeks, sloughs, anything you can name are in 4.5 pages of Section 10 waters that we will always have to deal with the Corps on. No way out of it. And I've talked to people in the Corps several times in the last month, and they've just said, you deal with us on that spirit. And I'll quit with that, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the time. Thank you.
You had something, Mr. Addington?
Mr. Chair, Greg Addington with the Farm Bureau. And just one thing I'd like to add in, and that is, It goes against the grain for us to oppose something called streamlining. I mean, that is naturally something we're very much supportive of. For us, though, the devil is in the details. And I guess I would just like to throw out that I appreciate the department's willingness to work with us, and they certainly have. I mean, we've had many, many face-to-faces with them, and would be supportive, I think, of the of Director Hannes's idea of continuing that dialogue with stakeholders in the interim. I would just encourage that the department get some landowners involved on that stakeholder group as well.
Could I add, Mr. Chairman, I too have spent 4 hours with Mr. John Lilly of DSL, 2 hours with Greg, and 2 hours with another guy in Tillamook. In fact, he came to Tillamook. And I appreciate that from the agency. They're spending time with us. We just, in those 4 hours, we just never accomplished what I wanted to accomplish. So.
Okay.
But I appreciate the time they spent.
Thank you all very much for your testimony here today.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
I just wanted to ask a question, Mr. Buck, if I might.
Sure.
Mr. Beck, as you can tell, I'm trying to learn about these issues. Can you tell me what it is that you do on your farm that requires this permit, a permit that concerns you if we were to pass this House bill?
On my, Chairman Jensen and Representative Tomei, on my farm, I'm on the higher end of the floodplain. I cleaned my 3,000 feet of ditches in a, once in 1972 and 25 years later. That's all I needed. But under some of this stuff, if you, it sounds like if you let these are, more than 6 years...
These are drainage ditches? These are ditches for...
they're drainage.
Water. Okay, thank
they're
you.
They're drainage. Okay. In converted wetlands. In what's called converted wetlands.
They are in converted wetlands?
Pasture. They're pasture land in Tillamook, my farm. Right?
I
they're
see.
Just pasture land. Right?
Okay.
And I up to this point, I never had to get a permit, and I don't know if I if the person who bought my farm would need to or not down the road.
In order to clean out your drainage
ditches. Because there is items in here about if you don't do this every 6 years, then you've abandoned it, and then you've got to get a permit. And when I talk to our NRCS people, they just say, we don't want that. We don't want you cleaning a ditch just because the law says you have to do it when it's not necessary.
Okay.
And I don't want to put out the money here.
I have a clear picture. Thank you, Mr. Buck. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Clarence Boquist, and I'm sorry, I've got an L.A.
Dana.
Is that? And Chris Bahan. And gentlemen, we're short as we can be on time, so as short as you can make it, boy, please lead off, whoever, just introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Bud Ginger. I have a farm in Tillamook County. We're on the web wetlands. We have a lot of the area between the Kilchis River and the Wilson River, about 1,000 acres. Have a huge dairy. And I, like Bob Caravan, have had trouble with the DSL on regulations, cleaning out a ditch. I'm still fighting a problem. And rather than go on and tell you all the details, and I would entertain that I would answer any questions you might have. Anyway, in November of last year, cleaning a ditch, I had a stop and desist order from the, and by that stop and desist, I had to stop doing my project, and it still isn't solved yet. And the farm, there's a lot of the areas of the farm that we can't farm because of that. And this is a huge defense bill that's built up for me to defend myself. So I haven't had a good relationship working with DSL. And we have the county involved, also for another form of government that's involved, and we have the Army Corps of Engineers. So I think we have way too much regulation and too many problems for hoops to go through to do just general farm work, just general cleaning out a small ditch caused a lot of havoc. So I would say that I think this assumption bill is bad, and I think we could save a whole lot of money like some other folks have suggested and do away with DSL. Thank you.
Thank you. Is it Bud?
Right.
Thank you, Bud. Appreciate your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Clarence Boquist, a retired dairyman from Tillamook, Oregon. I was born on the dairy that I was ran for, my wife and I ran for 50 years. I am against this bill, and I'll tell you why. Over the 50 years that I was on the farm, we had to deal with the log jams, the silt that came down the rivers, the ditch, open drainage ditches that plugged up with silt, the reseeding of the land. And we also had one gravel bar, which we took a little gravel off now and then. I might take off 5 yards 1 year. 20 yards another year, no yards in different years. And for the life of me, I can't understand why we would have to be forced to get a permit for any one of these practices. From what I've had to do with the permit process, it can take a long time. I'm talking about years, not months. Anyway, I'm against it.
Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it.
Chair Jensen, committee members, my name is Chris Baham. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. I'm their environmental coordinator for their county road program. I'd like to say that the Association of Oregon Counties supports House Bill 2082, and that support stems from our view of how the assumption of Section 404 by DSL would improve the permitting for county road program construction projects. AOC's members passed a resolution at their fall conference last year, and that resolution supports the passage of House Bill 2082, and that resolution is based in part on the Oregon Association of County Engineers and Surveyors' support for passage of House Bill 2082, and also for the county road director's perspective that assumption of the streamlining of Section 404 and DSL's removal full permit program would improve the permitting process for county road programs and their projects, and it would reduce the time delays associated with the permitting process that they experience, and also save money. I've included in my written testimony an attachment of a flowchart that shows the current permitting program that we experience in Oregon today for removal fill activities for road construction projects, and what it would be under an assumed program. And as you can see, that the process would be greatly simplified. Every box that we have on the flowchart under the current permitting process represents a potential for a time delay and a potential for costs, added costs. We understand that there are some concerns about the workload that DSL would experience under an assumed program, and we share some of those concerns. We also heard earlier in testimony that DSL processes road construction permits from county road programs. And we are interested in any discussions that might be related to improving the process that DSL has established for processing removal fill permits. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Chris. I just have kind of one quick question, and it's a concern that all of these farmers that we've heard from today and from across the state, I assume are residents in your counties.
They are.
And I'm wondering what AOC has done to try to help work with the farm community to come up with something that is workable.
I don't have any direct experience with what specific counties are doing in terms of assisting farmers with the dual permitting process and making it more bearable for them to navigate and to comply with. I can look into that. My focus is primarily with county road departments, and that's the restrictions I have on my job activities due to my funding.
You understand one of the problems that I have, and I think that all of the members of the committee have, is when we have constituents come to us with, you know, real issues, real concerns, the thing that makes life easiest is if they've worked through the local governments and, you know, been able to kind of come with a united voice, or at least come to a point of we agree to disagree, sort of thing. And so my concern is, I guess, and it's not my business, obviously, to tell the county AOC what, you know, what their business should be, but I'd like to encourage, if there's any way you can work with the farmers, to maybe help us with that, because this seems to be something they are pretty pretty set in their opinions about, and makes it difficult for us to move forward with something like that under those circumstances. So I have no other. Thank you very much, gentlemen, all of you. Appreciate your testimony and your time here. I have two more people, and Mel Stewart, and we have Jeff Boatwright. And let me say, gentlemen, that you've got 2 minutes each, because we've got to move on in the agenda. So go ahead, Jeff.
All right. Jeff Boatwright from Albany, Oregon. I'm a small-scale placer miner. I think placer miners represent probably the largest collective group that is authorized through DSL. One thing I think is important in regard to that is that our activities, the core finds principally is a de minimis activity, which is a means or effective. Concerns a very small or trifling matter. The law does not concern itself with such matters, although DSL, on the other hand, is requiring general authorizations or individual removal fill permits, or possibly, with the legislation that was introduced this session, closing certain waterways to essential salmon habitat for removal fill activities. That's a pretty vast difference between the Corps of Engineers and DSL's policy. And I'm pretty concerned when they say they're going to streamline to take the Corps' position, whether that means they're going to do away with some of these considerations that they've had in their policies right now towards placer mining. Secondly, was the litigation involved right now. I mean, placer miners are involved in several lawsuits from environmental organizations. I feel like it makes more sense for the state of Oregon to have the Corps of Engineers be the ones that are handling these suits, because it costs the state a lot of money to fight these frivolous lawsuits, which eventually that the environmental organizations are able to strong arm our agencies to make compromises to try to avoid these costly litigations. When I feel that Corps of Engineers is better, more ably prepared to handle these suits because of their staffing and their budgets. I guess last is I prepared a detailed comment that, I mean, if you wanted to read it, but I wanted to say that what concerns me is the politics, basically, that political pressure as to personal views or party platforms may dictate more of what occurs in the administration policies and planning of the ever-expanding and evolving programs becoming more and more restrictive than the law itself. And it would serve us well to see the absurd types of contentious lawsuits that are considered and argued before the nation's courts as to even the most trivial activities as to violating the Clean Water Act in relation to these Section 404 activities and dredge and fill material. Suits that will cost us money and eventually leads to industries leaving our state. And I think it's sad to see that the benefit that we would receive, we still are going to consume these resources and need them, but the people have to end up leaving this state or leaving this country to be able to harvest these natural resources. It misrepresents the intent of what the Clean Water Act is, especially since the state and government agencies have invested millions of dollars into mapping, surveying, and assessing geologic resources, and they've worked extensively to publish reports, educate geologists and prospectors to work these deposits, and they recognize the importance they play in our society.
Appreciate the testimony, and yes, we do have your written comment.
Right.
And that is part of the record, and I know the committee will, as they always do, go through these and read them. Mel?
Mel Stewart.
Yeah.
Thank you.
A couple minutes, please.
Apologize for my dress. My dress, I was out on a job site pounding nails this morning, which is what I prefer doing. In the earlier testimony, particularly Representative Barnhart asked a question about the 50 cubic yard limit. In last legislative session, in Ms. Hannis' written testimony, she made an affirmative statement that the 50 cubic yard minimum would have to be removed in order to gain 404 assumption. I don't know if that's still the case, but I didn't hear a clear answer to that question this time. But I'm assuming that it is. In my last time I testified before this committee, I said that I'd done some work exploring the permit database of DSL, looking at the actual permits being issued, and that 3 out of 4 permits issued by DSL for wetlands were less than a half an acre in size, quarter acre in size. If we remove the 50 cubic yard limit, we're essentially making the mesh smaller and smaller. We're getting more and more little people to where if you want to go out and put a dump truck load of sandy loam in your garden, which may well be wetlands, you're going to need a permit from DSL. In Ms. Hannis' earlier testimony, she testified that the cost of processing these permits was $2,000 per permit processing for each permit. You may well increase your number of permits if you make the mesh tighter by removing the 50 cubic yard limit. You may well increase the number of permits you're going to have to process by 500 to 1,000. You don't know how large that number could actually be or how many people would actually comply with coming in and getting a permit. Nevertheless, if you look at the cost of processing those permits, it's going to have to be paid for by somebody. Either it's going to have to be paid for by the applicant or it's going to have to be paid for currently by the Common School Fund. Not good solutions. I also noticed that there are some key differences between... I do have some comments about differences between how the Corps of Engineers handles permits versus how DSL handles permits, but it's not... I'd waive them.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Al.
Thank you.
And with that, then, we're going to close... our public hearing on House Bill 2082, and I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2779. And first, I would like Mr. Day and is it Lodi Johnson?
Which bill are we hearing now?
2779.
Yes, I did see it.
It's for me.
It's a great piece.
Isn't it great? Let's see if they bring ours up.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, my name is Jim Day, resident of Central Oregon, and I'm here to support House Bill 2779. I'd ask that you consider 2 points, and I'll limit my input to those 2 points. The first one is that it's hoped that this legislation should provide additional dedicated funds to warm water fish species above and beyond the current existing budget levels and not result in a decreased baseline funding for warm water fish species from the sale of angling license or any other source. In other words, by creating additional funding, maintain the current level of funding that the state has for warm water fish species. The second point is that I hope a portion of the collected funds can be used to enhance the populations and quality of warm water fish species in general and largemouth bass in particular by purchasing or producing warm water fish stocks to supplement existing populations consistent with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife's warm water fish plan. As an example, Cream Prairie Reservoir last year, and this is information believed to be correct that was obtained from the warm water biologists in Central Oregon, that 150,000 trout were planted last year in Cream Prairie Reservoir. I requested information for history of how many warm water fish have been introduced in the state of Oregon for the last 4 years. So for the years 2000 through 2004, I received this information from the state. With a total of a little over 30,000 total warm water fish species that were planted or stocked into the existing program. That includes black crappie, hybrid bass, largemouth bass, and channel catfish. Of that, a total of 430 largemouth bass were either introduced or transferred within Oregon waters to other Oregon waters. I think some of the stocks that we have are declining. The juvenile bass recruitment is diminishing and in danger of collapsing in several of the reservoirs that we fish in Central Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Day. And before we go on, and before you go on, we're going to ask all of the people to try to keep your comments to a couple minutes, a couple 3 minutes. In the interest of time, it looks like we have overwhelming support for this bill by the group that is here today. And one other thing, just kind of an announcement, House Bill 2882 is being carried over until Wednesday of this week, so it'll be on the agenda then, if anybody is still here on 2882. Thank you. Please go ahead, Mr. Day.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, I want to thank you very much for allowing me to speak today. My name is Lonnie Johnson. I'm from Grants Pass, and I represent the Oregon Black Bass Action Committee, a volunteer consortium from 6 Southern Oregon bass clubs. I support House Bill 2779, and I strongly urge you to vote for it. 2779 could allow the reestablishment of a Western Oregon warm water fish biologist, absent since the retirement of Ken Daly on the western half of the state. This reestablishment would give organizations like ours direction in some of our projects. We are a volunteer group, not unlike many others, who are concerned about habitat, environment, and the future of our sport. There are many rehabilitation and conservation projects requiring funds that the OBBAC wants to address. 2779 and the funds that it would generate will allow us to do that. The warm water community, at least those in Southern Oregon, want to raise its own funds to pay for its own projects. 2779 will allow us to do exactly that. The warm water angling public is very large and growing in our state, and the returning of our warm water lakes and reservoirs to their former glory would increase revenues to the state in the form of licenses, camp fees, and other recreation money. Too many of our bass clubs are traveling to other states to hold tournaments due to decreased opportunities in Oregon to expect larger and healthier bags of fish. We all practice catch and release, and this helps keep our sport viable in Oregon, but so much more can be done with the passing of 2779. I am privileged to sit on the ODFW Warm Water Working Group, volunteers all, and the passing of 2779 would give us working monies to improve habitat and fish populations in our fine state. Again, I thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. Appreciate your being here and appreciate your testimony today. Thank you. And Charles Lang, Dave Daly, and Bud Hartman, please. Good afternoon. Proceed.
Good afternoon.
Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Representative Jensen, members of the committee, My name is Charles Lang. I was the conservation director for the Oregon Bass Federation for the past 8 years, just recently retired. I'm a member of the Warm Water Working Group and a member of the Fish and Wildlife's R&E Board for restoration and enhancement of habitat and work on hatcheries and things through the thing. I support House Bill 2779, and I also want to thank Representative Butler for bringing it and mention that Susan Foster, who was the previous chair of the Fish and Wildlife Commission, actually began this process of introducing this bill. She couldn't be here because of an illness, but anyway. I live in Salem, Oregon. Oregon has had warm water game fish since 1888. That was when they were first introduced. They were brought from the Illinois River from the sloughs and oxbows that were flooded by boxcar with an aquarium. Boxcar out to Oregon at that time when it started. And they have been there since then. They had a program that ran through the 1920s up to the 1960s to take the fish that had been established by those stockings and pass those through to all the other Oregon waters that are currently, most of those are currently under management today for warm water fish. According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the 2001 report entitled National Survey of Fishing, Hunting, and Wildlife Associated Recreation, the total expenditures for sportsmen for hunting and fishing related activities in Oregon was $1.3 billion. That came from 8.5 million angler days of fishing. Recreational fishing in Oregon is a huge, vital industry in Oregon. Also, according to the same report in an addendum, which is called the Black Bass Fishing Addendum, that was published in 1996, the total number of freshwater days in Oregon was 7,117,000. And the report estimates that of those freshwater days, $1.2 million of those were fishing for warm water species, which is 17% of the angling effort in Oregon. They estimated at that time 589,000 freshwater anglers, and that would be about 73,000 freshwater anglers would be 12% at that rate. If we charge $5 a piece, we would expect to find somewhere in the neighborhood of $360,000 a year going into the warm water budget, or 720,000 per biennium. And we think that that is a very conservative estimate, because the warm water angling hasn't actually been counted, the number of warm water anglers in the state, and we believe much, much higher, closer to 23% to 25% of the angling effort is warm water.
Could I?
Yes, sir.
Wrap up as quickly as you can, please.
I will. Warm water fishing represents an important industry, and it's important for the warm water anglers to basically get a fishery supported by Fish and Wildlife. We have been working with Fish and Wildlife for the past 10 years to establish sort of minimum things to go forward, and we've actually lost ground in terms of funding and personnel in Fish and Wildlife, and we would like to see this enhancement, or the enhancement funds, to bring us up to par. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your being here and appreciate your testimony.
Good afternoon, Representative Jensen, committee members. My name is Bud Hartman. I'm president of the Oregon Bass and Panfish Club, founded in 1958, the oldest and largest independent group in the state that is non-competitive oriented. We are a family fishing organization. We represent, with our paid membership, including your families, about 1,000 members. We have 350-some-odd dues-paying members, and we are all warm water fishermen. We have been interested in the plight of warm water fish in Oregon since our founding, and therefore we have put a lot of volunteer hours in working with ODFW to help them with projects that would benefit our fishery. We worked long and hard back in the late 50s and early 60s to get the Department of Fish and Wildlife, which was then the Oregon State Fish Commission and Game Commission, separate entities, to appoint a warm water biologist to the state of Oregon. We were very, very pleased when we managed to get them to hire one person that represented our interests statewide. Over the years, we have struggled to get more recognition. We got to the point where we had three biologists assigned to strictly warm water angling interests. We thought we had died and gone to heaven. Two of those biologists have subsequently retired in recent years, and we are back to square one. We have one biologist headquartered in Bend that is responsible for overseeing all of the warm water activities statewide, and we don't think that's enough. This bill, if enacted, would provide some funding dedicated to those kind of programs that interest our people. I don't believe the numbers that the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife puts out as far as the number of licensed anglers in the state of Oregon who actively pursue warm water fish. They estimate up to 14% of the licensed anglers fish for warm water fish. We think it's more like 50%. And they talk about 100,000 or so anglers in the state. We think there's probably in the neighborhood of 250,000 or so that are actively pursuing these critters. By contrast, the last time I looked at some of their budget figures, we have 21 biologists in the state dedicated to managing and overseeing quote-unquote cold water fisheries and one overseeing warm water fisheries. We think it's time that our people get represented, and we are adamantly in favor of this bill. We're willing to pay our share. We want the monies dedicated, and it would do one other very important thing. It would finally provide a yardstick to measure the kind of activity that goes on in this state through the sale of these tags. We would finally have some numbers that we can rely on and say, this is who's doing what in the state, rather than guesswork that we're doing now. So we strongly support House Bill 2779.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, my name is Dave Daly. I'm currently Oregon Bass Federation Youth Director. I live in Millbrook, Oregon. Thank you for allowing us to speak today. I'm here, obviously, in support of House Bill 2779, together with Amendment HB 2779-1. That is an amendment that changes from the original writing to make the permit amount $5 rather than $10, and also to exclude kids below the age of 18 from purchase requirement. Very much support what's been presented by the speakers ahead of me. I'm in full agreement with them, so we won't go back over that. Warm water fish are really a key element for youth fishing. ODFW spends a lot of money with a put and take fishery with trout statewide, some very expensive fish. And kids get a chance to fish with that some if they happen to get down to the dock near a stocking point. Well, the fish are young and stupid, but they assume they move for cooler water and the carryovers to deeper water. If those kids are not involved, if their family doesn't have a boat or friends have a boat to get them out there, they don't get to fish for those fish. On the other hand, warm water fish tend to occupy the shallow littoral zones where they are available for fishing, and they're readily attracted to fish attractors to enhance bank fishing where these kids can learn to fish. The youth are our future, and it's important to get them fishing at a young age. We've seen license sales decline steadily over the years. Warm water fishery is an important fishery with a minimal amount of funding put into habitat. And these fish, I mean, they reproduce, take care of their own stocking issues. We don't have to spend a lot of money on that. So it's very important, I think, that we do dedicate and focus more on some warm water fishery to enhance this, not only for the youth, but for the adults. I'm a bass fisherman. I enjoy bass fishing. They're a little tough to catch for kids. But bluegill, perch, crappie, that sort of thing. It's a good place for kids to start. And this would help provide some funding to go towards that. We're doing some short and long-term planning. I and Chuck both currently sit on the warm water working group, working with ODFW, trying to work towards enhanced warm water fisheries. We're very much in favor of this and hope that you will vote to pass it. On behalf of the youth of the state, specifically, and warm water fishermen in general, I really urge you to support this bill with the amendment.
Very much, gentlemen. Representative Falco.
I can't help myself, Mr. Chair. I'm sort of in a talking mood today, right? It's a reference from our earlier business. No, I really appreciated that last testimony because I sat here thinking to myself, remembering my childhood when I grew up in New York City and I had a best friend that moved out to Connecticut, and I can remember going to taking the bus to go visit him, leaving the city. That's a big thing for kids in New York City, to get out of the city for the summer and visit your friends. And so he lives in a place called Kent, Connecticut, and we were 8 years old, maybe 9 years old, and we'd grab our fishing tackle and at 9 years old and go down to this river called the Housatonic River and kind of wade our way through the through the brush and everything, and we caught a couple of fish and brought it back, and we were really proud. So I know what you're talking about, kind of inspiring a lifetime of that activity. It's fun.
Well, Chair Jensen, Representative Delta, I wish I had the opportunity to do what you talked about as a child. That's one thing that's important to me. I didn't really get into fishing until about 1992. My folks worked very hard and didn't have the opportunity to take us fishing. I can remember maybe three or four times going to a lake across towards St. Paul. The only thing we fished for was warm water. Dad didn't know that much, and we had a bobber and a worm and caught some bluegill. But I regret greatly never having that opportunity. The years missed, and that's something I'd like to see change. I'd like to see the opportunities for youth statewide, and ODFW, it is a high priority for them, is youth fishing opportunities. And I think that involves very much warm water fisheries.
Thanks very much for what you're doing.
Maybe one of you gentlemen can tell me that in our summation here it says sunfish families, perch families, and catfish families. Are any of these indigenous fish species to Oregon, or have these all been brought into Oregon from somewhere?
May I try to answer?
Sure.
There are 16 subspecies of warm water fish recognized in the state of Oregon. There is only one that is native west of the Rocky Mountains, and that's the Sacramento perch. Currently, it's found only in southern Oregon in the Lost River and where it flows into northern California. All of the rest were brought here at one time or another by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service or by man, starting back in about 1880 to 1882, and they've received widespread introduction and spreading through plantings, legal plantings, in the early 1900s, and the rest is legend, but none are native to the state of Oregon, or Washington, or California for that matter, except the Sacramento perch.
And so this tag for this type of fishery that we're talking about here wouldn't be required to fish for
any of these species.
For any of those species? Would that include walleye on the Columbia River?
Yes. That walleye is part of the family, but it's actually biologically considered what they call a cool water fish. It's of the same genre as a yellow perch. They are cousins to each other, and they're the only two species found in Oregon that are of that same gender or genre, if you will. But walleye would be included, and we're not proposing a harvest tag. We're proposing merely a stamp or some means of identifying a person as a warm water angler. And we want to do that for the two reasons cited, at the risk of repeating myself. Primarily to provide some funding to get a little more emphasis put on warm water management, but secondarily, primarily to measure the amount of activity in the state of Oregon. Right now, we have no way of knowing how many people are out there pursuing these critters.
I should know, but I know I can't recall right off right now. How much does a fishing license cost in the state of Oregon? Yeah.
I'm a Pioneer license holder, so I don't really know what it's up to now. But it's in the neighborhood of $22, something like that, I think, round figures.
Do you have any idea how many of them are issued in Oregon each year?
According to the figures I've got right here, for 2004, I quoted one number from this as far as the percentage of warm water anglers. Harry Upton, ODFW economist, says that the number of licensed anglers in 2004 was 451,582. Now, as Mr. Daly alluded to earlier, that's a little bit of a reduction. I can remember a couple of years ago when it was in excess of 600,000. Our population has grown, but license sales have gone down. And I think a lot of it is because of reduced opportunity, reduced places where people can pursue the kind of critters they want to fish for, I think. But anyway, 451,582 in 2004.
Do you have any kind of an estimate on how many, and follow up this year, any kind of an estimate on how many anglers would be buying this tag then?
Their best guesstimate, their economist guesstimates up to 23%. We seriously think it's a little higher than that, and that's why we're anxious to get it implemented, because we'd really know then how many people are pursuing these critters. But they say upwards of almost a fourth, about 103,000 in 2004, they estimated were warm water anglers. And by the way, there are a lot of voters, too.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate
your
testimony.
Mr. Chair, may I ask one real quick question?
But of course.
And then I'll get out of here. And that is, thank you, Mr. Chair, and that is, you made the comment that you wanted the money to go for a biologist or to pay for more biologists for warm water fishing. Is it in relation to the bill, is it in the first section where it talks about the warm water game fish subaccount is established and that monies in the subaccount shall be used for the protection and enhancement of warm water fish? Is that kind of where...
Yeah, that's
is
all.
That the innocuous way of our instruction to the department to hire a warm water biologist?
Well, it would do that, plus it would provide funding for support activities. I mean, there's habitat to be considered, there's fuel for vehicles to be considered, there's a whole plethora of things that get involved more than just the salary of a biologist. So it would support activities that would enhance this fishery statewide, we hope.
Okay.
Chair Jensen, great, if I may, you're asking about the numbers. A few years ago, Washington State established a $5 warm water stamp or tag, and discovered after a few years they had so many fishermen they had been missing. They eventually eliminated the tag to get away from the headache of dealing with that, but they now have a $3.3 million budget. I think it's something like 21 biologists devoted to warm water fisheries. And it's a big part of their fisheries. I think another individual may have some more specific info there. But they discovered that they had been missing a very large portion of the population that was interested in that fishery.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you. I'm going to ask Roy Elliker at this point to come up. And my reason for doing this is one of my committee has to leave. We're going to continue beyond the 3 o'clock hour to hear all of you. I'm not sure who all will still be here, but I will be here to hear all of the testimony. But I wanted Roy comments for Representative Dinkfelder especially to have you. I understand that.
Roy, you're going to be quick, right?
I'm going to be very quick.
Because I have an appointment, yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name for the record is Roy Elliker. I'm the Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. On my right, Mr. Ryan Mesmer, our Recreational Program Leader for Fisheries. And I will make it very quick, Mr. Chair, and get right to the issue of the bill. You've heard a lot of good testimony here by members of the Warm Water Working Group, which is a very important group to the department, formed in 2002. They have provided a lot of input and a lot of constructive criticism about warm water fisheries in the state, and it is an important
economic issue, particularly in good years. And the one example I cite in the first part of my testimony, for instance, there at Brownlee Reservoir in Baker County, when fishing was very hot then in the early 90s, we figured that the 1 year alone meant an additional $4 million in economic input into the county. And that was, I think, 1989. Let me get right to the bill, sir, because time is limited. The department had, if you look at page 2 of my prepared testimony, it gets to the three issues there, particularly we just want to mention about the bill. First of all,
right before you proceed, are you going to be proposing any amendments, or have you proposed amendments?
We have not spoken to anyone about amendments, sir. We would like a little change in language, so if this was not going to move today, we might ask for an amendment.
We will not. We do not have it scheduled for work session. We won't move it today. And if you have amendments or discussion relating to that, when we bring it back, we'll bring it back as a work session, but we'll invite the department to testify on any amendments, and maybe even some, not maybe even some, and anyone who would be opposed to those amendments.
So. Thank you, Chair Jensen. I understand our first issue from the department was the issue of the juvenile fishing issues. A lot of young kids start fishing on warm water fish, and so we were hoping that the tag, if the legislature decided a tag or stamp was necessary, that wouldn't go into effect till you're after 18 or at some appropriate age rather than right from the start. And I think there's an amendment one, I've been told, that would change the age requirement for the tag. I haven't seen it myself, but that's what I'm told anyway, sir, and be happy to look at that for the work session. Our second issue is the language specifically calls for protection enhancement of warm water fish. And frankly, we'd like to change that language slightly, perhaps to say something that the monies would be used for warm water fish management that optimizes user benefits and is consistent with the conservation of native Oregon fish. That was just some language we came up with, Mr. Chair. We're happy to work with the sponsors to build on that. The third issue, probably of most concern, is that, and as you know very well, Mr. Chair, normally when we go for a fee increase or a change in fee status for the department, because it affects so many folks, we generally have an extensive public process that we go through. And, of course, this one has not had that through the department. And I want to be sure to make sure the committee was aware of that. So as far as the department knows, we're not aware of what the general angling public would feel about this tag proposal or whether support it or oppose it. I know the organized warm water fishing groups are very supportive and very adamant they would like to have this. And like I said, so that ends my prepared comments.
Thank you, Roy. And I think there are enough of the proponents of this bill here that you've heard what Mr. Elliker has to say about the department's concern. I'd like to have you either communicate with the department or with the chair in relationship to those concerns and where you might be, what your attitude and ideas on that might be before we proceed down the road with any type of work session on this bill. If I could ask you to do that, I would surely appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, we'll work closely with the folks in the room.
Thank you. Sure. I appreciate that, Roy, and I'm sure you will. Does that answer your questions, Representative?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize, I have to leave for an appointment.
That's fine. We understand that. And you will, those of you who are here yet to testify, will understand that some of the representatives have other commitments. But you can also be pretty assured that they will be appraised of what your testimony is here today. And for that matter, if I know some of them, they will be listening to the tape to see what you had to say. So we'll proceed on with the individuals we have signed up. I've got an Art Israelson, is that correct? And I also have a Catherine.
I will defer my comments.
You will defer your comments to him? Okay. You were signed up in different lines there, and I, in light of the fact you were using the same telephone and so forth, I assumed that you probably knew each other and would have similar, comments, but that's fine. Then I have Dennis Ritchie. And Bill Egan. Is that right? correct?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Go ahead, please, Art.
My name is Art Israelson. I'm a member of the Oregon Bass and Panfish Club. I am also the director for the Northwest Steelheaders River Access Issues. A lot will be said about the amount of money that is spent for high-tech equipment to catch these warm water fish. There are a lot of people in the state that rely on these fish for subsistence fishing. It doesn't take, except for maybe bass and walleye, a lot of very expensive equipment to catch some of the warm water fish. As an example, I see this little device used frequently to catch the warm water fish. It's a spin casting outfit. Many, many people in this state use these for subsistence fishing. I only know of one major project in the state that has been used for warm water fishing and the propagation of warm water fish, and that's the St. Paul Ponds. These were created and started in 1950, and the difference between a warm water pond and a hatchery is that these fish are not fed at St. Paul. They eat natural products that are there, so they're not fed manually. The only problem that St. Louis has had is the major program was suspended for lack of funds over the years. And all this history I've given to you, gentlemen. I'm very much in favor of 2779. Most of the things I want to say have already been presented. The majority of the people here are angler education instructors, volunteers for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And we see a great many children that we would like to have fishing. And warm water fishing is the place they can start. I think that Representative Brown was kind of hinting at the fact that these are not native fish. They were introduced here legally. How long do they have to be here before they're residents? How many of us are natives of Oregon? How many of our grandparents were natives of Oregon? We consider ourselves natives. Why should these fish be considered anything else? Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony, Art. And as a non-native to the state, I can understand your comment there. Of course, Representative Galto started out clear on the other side of the United States, so he hasn't figured out yet whether he came east or went west. So at least you're talking to two of the, if you wish, non-natives of the fish. However, I think all joking aside, there obviously are some federal programs in addition to some of our own state things that do get into this definition of what is and what isn't a native fish. And
I think that quite possibly that if the state became more involved in stocking of warm water fish, that there would be considerably less illegal stocking of these fish.
Yeah.
One of the things that it said in the St. Paul material I gave you was, several factors have contributed to an increased interest in warm water game fish in Oregon within the past 15 years. This was back in 1950. Primary importance is the influx of people from the east of the Rocky Mountains. Sportsmen from Midwestern and Southern states learned to appreciate bass and panfish in their home states before taking up residence in Oregon.
And one of the things, as far as fishing is concerned, warm water fishing and the points that you've made, the relationship to cost and sometimes the ease of fishing, I really don't know of anything a lot better for a young boy to do than get a fishing pole in his hand and go out on the bank someplace and drown worms and occasionally bring home a fish. Moving right along then. Please.
I'm Dennis Ritchie, Executive Director of Oregon Anglers. It's based in West Lynn, but we have our political base throughout all of Western Oregon, about 3,200 members now, and the Oregon Bass and Panfish Club is one of the clubs that we do work with. But we have clubs that raise salmon as volunteer hatcheries. We have steelheader groups. We have groups like here in Salem, the Mid-Willamette Valley Anglers that fish for everything. And I would definitely agree with what's been said before, that I think the number of warm water anglers is much, much higher than is estimated. I myself fish primarily probably for salmon and steelhead, but I go warm water fishing with kids and take kids fishing two or three times a year and enjoy it as much as catching a large salmon. I serve on the Native Fish Conservation Plan Committee, the Coastal Coho Recovery Team, and the Ocean Sport Fishing Advisory Committee, and among others. And I have not talked to any anglers who oppose this bill at all. I think it's widely accepted, and I think it makes a lot of sense. And I hope that when you look at the final touches on this bill, that you make sure it does go into dedicated funds. I think that's an important part that hasn't been emphasized enough. Lastly, salmon numbers have been up, you know, in the last 5 or 6 years. And everybody makes a big deal about how fishing is great in Oregon, but overall opportunities are down because so many of our streams are no longer planted with trout. And I think a good, strong warm water program will take up that slack. Thank you.
Thank you. Bill?
Chair Jensen, representative. Thank you for your time. My name is Bill Egan. I've been involved in fisheries for the last 30 years. I've been president of the Steelhead Chapters. I've been president of tournament clubs. I'm currently the information director for the Bass and Panfish Club. Most of my material has been covered, but something else that hasn't been brought up. The current ODFW regs list fisheries advisories for the state. Not all state waters have been sampled for contaminants. The warnings that they have in the ODFW regs are 10 to 12 years old. There's no plans. Dave Stone, who's the human services toxicologist for the state, says they have no plans to go back and check and monitor for PCBs, mercury, dioxins, pesticides. There's no money, no plans. The Oregon survey on the Snake River at Brownlee, when we did it, we didn't show any problems. Idaho's did. They showed a moderate mercury level. So we went with Idaho's. This was 12 years ago, and nothing's been done since. Hopefully, money would be available to do some monitoring on most waters, and most waters that currently have advisories are warm water waters, exceptions being East Lake and a couple others. The warm water fisheries are basically self-supporting. They're enjoyed by thousands. We're willing to pay for dedicated warm water funds to protect and monitor and enhance the fisheries. Thank you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I appreciate your time, your effort, and your testimony. And Marcia Hartman. And Don Hibden and Donald Baskett. Please proceed, Marcia. Heavens.
Representative Jensen and Representative Dalton, thank you for remaining here. I would like to say that I've been involved with warm water fishing since my husband, Bud Hartman, introduced me to that. He's from the East Coast. He fished for warm water fish there. I, as almost a pioneer, well, I am a pioneer of Oregon, but not a native Oregonian. I'm from Idaho. I did not know that warm water fish existed in Oregon. And I today am still surprised that many Oregonians do not know what a warm water fish is. It's true, Oregon is known for its salmon, steelhead, and trout. But this other fishery is very viable. Over the years that Bud and I have been involved with the Department of Fish and Wildlife working on warm water fish issues, we have been encouraged to stay involved and to help with different projects, but we also hear from the department that funding is not available to pursue the things that could enhance the fishery. This tag will dedicate funds, and that is the main purpose for the warm water tag, to have dedicated funds to enhance the fishery. It, the amendment to the House Bill 2779 will exempt children under the age of 18 from having to purchase this tag, and I think that we would appreciate your support. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Marcia, and I'm happy that you got an opportunity to be introduced to warm water fishing,
yes,
even if you had to kind of take the expensive route of doing it.
Yes, but it's been okay. 47 years later, we're still enjoying fishing, and our sons do too. Okay.
Thank you very kindly. Please, the Don Hipton.
Yes, thank you, Chair Jensen. Looks like you're the only one left. One thing I just wanted to agree with everybody else in support of the bill, and I think it's going to help, like they had said before, determine how many people we actually do have fishing for warm water fish. I think it's going to be a larger number than they expect. It's also going to give us the dollars that they need for their biologists, for their habitat, and for stocking. And I think we can even work in some youth programs through that to get more youth involved. And with the salmon, steelhead, sturgeon limits and days you can fish going lower and lower every year, I think you're losing people from that fishing, and they don't know that there's warm water fish out there to pursue. I think this would give us an opportunity to maybe those people that aren't buying the licenses anymore and leaving, maybe we can get them back and on board with the warm water fisheries. Thank you.
Thank you. Very good point. Appreciate it. And then we got Donald Baskett.
Yeah.
Good afternoon, sir.
Thank you for let me testify. I go along with everybody else that you've heard that I am in favor of House Bill 2779, and I'm a sports fisherman, and normally you wouldn't hear fishermen asking for a raise in their fees if you fish for warm water, but I would be more than willing to pay a fee if those fees are designated for the warm water fishing. And that's pretty much all I have to say.
Thank you, Donald. And I would make one observation. I believe, I don't know whether Roy's still there or not, but I think the department probably would concur that the fishing community are, you know, certainly nobody wants to pay any more fees than they have to pay, but the fishing community has been, you know, basically very supportive during my tenure in this building when they were, there was a request for increased fees or something of that nature in, you know, helping us get those and bring those fees, bring those things about. I mean, they know very well that it costs money to maintain the programs that that the Department of Fish and Wildlife has to maintain and to supervise, and you know that. So I just would like to extend to one aspect or one part of the community of sportsmen and fishermen here my appreciation for your willingness to support with your pocketbook, if you wish, those activities that you find near and dear to your heart. And again, that an activity I think that is terribly important for our young people. I believe we get more people, young people out fishing, we could have maybe a few less other problems that that we have in our state. So thank you all for coming, and kind of my apology for the fact that we ran over, but I didn't want to ask you to come back, and I wanted to hear everyone and what you had to say. So I do appreciate your staying here, and I'm sure the committee is willing to work with the department and with you all to come up with a bill here that's going to basically do what you want to do to improve warm water fishing in the state as such. So thanks again.
Thank you.
And with this, the last note that I got from my staff was, don't forget to gavel out. So we are adjourned.